With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram Bounce.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood, I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Video Week, and in this episode I'm speaking to Elizabeth Anigbuna. Elizabeth is the CEO at 16x9. They're a contextual media agency, and they work with brands to create ads and content across pretty much every platform that you can think of. Elizabeth has had a very interesting career. Before setting up her company, she earned her stripes in the TV space, which in the UK, at least, there was a certain period where it was something of a baptism of fire. We dig into those experiences and how they formed her. Elizabeth has also been hugely committed to making our industry a little bit fairer and to make it more inclusive. She's currently the president of Bloom, which are a network and support group for women working in communications in the UK. Incredibly impressive organization. And she's also launched a new group of her own called Join Our Table, which I think is a fantastic name. And that aims to amplify the work of black women in advertising. We've got a few things coming up. We've got New Video Frontiers in March. You want to book your tickets or your flights or whatever else, or if you want to partner with us, now is the time to get in touch. This is our flagship conference. We had over 1,000 people registered last year. It goes from March 20th to 21st in London. And if you'd like to get in touch, you can drop me a note via LinkedIn or get in touch via the Video Week or the New Video Frontiers website. We also have a video advertising guide coming up, which will map out the what's happening in cross-channel video advertising. If your company would like to feature in that or to be included in the industry maps, it's very annoying when people get in touch with us after the guide. So please do get in touch to let us know that you should be on those maps beforehand. Making those edits afterwards is both expensive and takes a while to do. So yeah, get in touch if you want to be featuring that one. And we're also going to be mapping out the out-of-home side of video, looking at the way that whole ecosystem is evolving. We have a new guide coming up on that too. So again, just drop us a note. Right, now let's crack on with my conversation with Elizabeth, which I hope you enjoy. Hey Elizabeth, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Vincent. Hi, I'm super excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Energetic start. That's what I like. Okay, so firstly, yeah, one of the things that we always like to do, and I know that you're somebody who's passionate about, you know, making the industry more accessible for people. But I'm curious about what was your entry point? What was your beachhead into the industry? And, you know, how did you end up, you know, in the ad world in the first place?
So I'm one of those, like I think a lot of us really, where I fell into it, you know, even though I would say that I sort of do believe in manifestation, you know, and I always used to think, you know, I'd really love to work for MTV at the time, so early 20s. And then a friend of mine told me to go for a job at Sky. The job was actually in the traffic department. I have to confess, I had no idea what traffic was in relation to a media a company. I thought it was vehicles. But I did my research, went for the job, got it. I had a wonderful boss, actually, called Lynn. I managed 9 months there before they realized that I am far too social and chat a lot. And so then I moved into the ad sales, the sales side of things. You know, so sort of things around sort of more sort of trading and spot buy and as in ad buy and so on. So I started at Sky, you know, which was my amazing grounding, to be honest with you, a big, obviously, company. And they, apart from the channels that they do have, Sky, they had some joint venture ones as well, Nickelodeon being one of them. And I absolutely loved that particular channel. So I moved from there into dealing more with Nickelodeon when there was a change of hands when the ad sales side of things moved to Viacom. And then I moved into more sort of partnerships and content, and as well as all still under sales. And then I then moved from there to Viacom and actually realized my dream of working for MTV, because of course MTV is part of one of the channels at Viacom. So yes, I started in traffic. I fell into media. I actually studied English literature and law, so nothing to do with media. And ended up where I am now. And then, so yes, I've moved from Viacom, worked on the sort of channels there, sort of more content, branded content, should I say, partnerships, sponsorships, digital media, as in on you know, handling their websites. And yeah, I just sort of moved up really, and then became, yeah, partnerships director, and then moved to a couple of other sort of broadcast media. So Turner, A&E, I've kind of done all of them really. Came back to Sky, actually, my alma mater, when they had taken on Channel 5. So dealt with that before I launched my agency, which is 16 by 9 as it is now. So that's kind of like a whistle-stop tour of my journey.
Great, though. No, it's yeah, so many of the companies you mentioned, it's so common for people in the industry to have, particularly in the UK, to have either passed through ITV or Sky at some point in their career. And like I say, it often does seem to be a great grounding for people because they often seem to go on to greater things. So what led you to set up your own company? And you know, what is 16 by 9, and what do you, you know, what is it that you bring to the market? I mean, I know, but I think not everyone will.
So I've always had a kind of an entrepreneurial way, you know, of approaching work, you know, I knew that at some point I was going to, well, I had the desire to set my own business up at some point, and it did, like I say, present itself in how I approach things. So that, I suppose, entrepreneurial, you know, spirit always sat in me when I kind of looked at most of the things I did. In my journey, I didn't mention that I kind of a little bit went to the left a bit when, not left, I just went elsewhere when I joined a company called GTV. This is after Viacom. That was a sub-Saharan African country company. And I set up the ad sales team there and the whole sort of department there. And it gave me a little bit, it was a smaller company compared to obviously all the big ones that I'd been working for. And what it did was it allowed me a peek into the working for a smaller company, pulling up your sleeves and sort of doing it all, but then realizing, you know, huge dividends, because you are doing way more than I guess your only role or when you are working in corporate. So I did go back to UK and a corporate with Turner, but I eventually then decided, right, it's now time to set up with my business partner. So still wanted to stay true to where I've come from, i.e. broadcast media, and also stay true to content, because like I said before, you know, with MTV and Nickelodeon and Turner's channels across the network, I loved the content. I loved being near the audience, the creativity that you kind of had, you know. So it was fun, the types of brands. And so staying true to that with 16 by 9, the agency is one that we focus on above line AV, so TV, video, screen-based media, whether it's digital, outdoor, or cinema, and so on. So the moving image. So I still stay true to that with 16 by 9. And by the way, 16 by 9, of course, if you haven't got it already, is the aspect ratio of the screen.
And I think what sparked you to say that was my confession that it only clocked. Before Video Week, I had my own company where I was doing video editing and video production. I've been running Video Week for 11, 12 years, and it took me an embarrassingly long time to go, oh my God, of course, 16 by 9 is the aspect ratio.
That is hilarious.
It's a fantastic name for a company. I know this is a slightly subjective question, but I mean, what do you think are the key ingredients for a great content marketing campaign? I mean, you guys focus mostly on content, what do you think are the sort of really those key ingredients? There's always a tension. I think there was a time where people would pretend it was a science, but I think there's definitely more art and creativity involved. But yeah, what are the key ingredients that people can use as sort of guardrails to produce something worth producing?
So I would say relevant branded content. If you're thinking of the target audience and the challenges that you're trying to speak to, then the content needs to be relevant. As talking to what you're sort of saying, I think the ideal is a integrated type of strategy when it comes to distribution. So yes, you sort of look at your organic, I suppose, SEO, website content, that kind of thing, but then mix it up with your paid, social media, and some would argue sort of influencers and things like that. Now, of course, me being me, I am going to say that then the ideal icing on the cake would be to add above the line, because the strength of that is the awareness, of course, reaching mass reach, expanding that organic side of things with the content marketing, and sort of sending your audience direct to the content, which above the line does well. The other thing also, content marketing is. And this is why I guess I sit where I sit, is that emotional connection that you always get when you watch, something on screen. You're leaning in and more engaged and immersed in it, versus maybe something that's moving at a faster pace and that's short and quick. So I would say a blended mixture, really. Yes, there's an argument for organic, but topping it up with paid and then 100% above the line gives your maximum exposure and engagement.
And the journalist in me has to sort of bust through any jargon. So when you say above the line, what do you mean by that?
So I'm talking about those sort of like big, bigger mediums, that tends to go mass reach. So TV, outdoor, cinema, radio. Yeah, those ones are sort of above the line versus your SEO, so your search engine, Google Ads type digital.
I think it's presented to the viewer as it feels a bit more authentic if it's embedded in publication rather than just, driving traffic to a YouTube page or
that's
whatever
exactly
else.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like that there is something where it seems more credible, I think, probably.
Yeah, I think it is. I think a mixture. They all have their roles, but that if you ask most people what ad they remember, most of the time it's something that they've seen that's longer and on big screen than necessarily on a TikTok.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say. So obviously it's the impact, but they all have their roles.
One thing we used to see commonly at events would be, there'd be this content marketing versus advertising. And it'd be like, people don't want ads anymore. They want content, they want to be engaged with in this way and that way. And, they want an authentic conversation with the brand. And I feel like that conversation has faded away a little bit and everyone's just happily coexisting and often working together. But, what is the best way to distribute content, do you think, when you mentioned the above the line, but the idea that you could just put out a video and it would become viral, it does happen, but it's reasonably rare, I think. And even the ones that the famous viral campaigns often had some paid or some sort of, you know, some form of distribution backing it up. It wasn't just the content was let loose in the wild and ran free around the internet. But yeah, what's the best way, do you think?
Yeah, I think pretty much what you sort of said, really. Yeah, yes, as much as you would get some who would think that you just rely on organic. And we come across those, not we come across those sorts of brands all the time, but we do come across or have a few brands who are digital first, you know, so they start off that way, but then they hit a point where they do need to reach mass. And because they may be doing okay, but people don't necessarily know the brand, or they do know the brand, but they've hit a ceiling because they're not reaching those people in that. Well, they're not getting the story across. And I think when you then are a bit more intentional with your paid mixed in with the organic, as I said before, that is your perfect combo, you know, because you know you put a bit of science behind it, right? You know, you've checked the data, you know who you're targeting, you know what you need to say to these people, and then you're more visible, you know, as a result. So yeah, you do get some who think that if I'm just organic and I push it out there and it's word of mouth, and it's not that it doesn't work for some people, but they still use influencers, or they'll still use some other form of marketing, right? But certainly having that combo where it's paid and targeted and intentional is your ideal. And content, I mean, like I said, I've come from broadcast media world, so I love good content. I love content in context. You know, I prefer a contextual buy, you know, versus a scattergun approach. Although they do, again, I mean, it serves a purpose for some, but my ideal is to have some kind of relevance in an ad or a place, you know, versus just sending it out there into the ether and hoping for the best. So yes, I think the story in the content, good content. Yes, organic, of course, but paid to be intentional and deliberate is the best blend.
Yeah, you mentioned those digital first advertisers who, you know, hit their ceiling in terms of reach, and they sort of often, one thing I hear frequently, and it's usually in pub conversations or coffee shops, but I hear that many of them have very deluded expectations around how they're going to grow the company, because they have that initial period where they can focus on quite narrow audiences, see quite big, huge instant uplift, and then when they hit that ceiling, they don't realize that, you know, that isn't how the world works, you know. That's and that exactly you right. have to become famous, and that often the ROI is often it's in order to build that brand, it sort of takes more time and requires more investment that they aren't necessarily prepared for.
Well, exactly right. You've got to ask the question why big brands still pay to you know, advertise. Yep. You know, there is a reason for it, because, you know, some one or two, and I won't sort of name the brands, you know, have thought that they can rely on their reputation. But the problem with that is when they come off, others take their place, and we are, you know, we move on, because you go, we'll follow what you see, because of course advertising builds trust. It's, you know, it shows you're still relevant, all that sort of other stuff. So you can't be complacent. You might even manage to stay off for a year or say, for example, but then you then do have to kind of come back, because people will forget you.
It's amazing. It's funny you say that, because we see this all the time, even with ad tech vendors, where they kind of think they've reached full of penetration, and then if they disappear, and I think the period is roughly around, you know, 6 months to a year even.
Yeah.
And people start to ask if they're still going. Does that company still exist? It's incredibly quick where people, because we're, you know, especially in an area like tech where everything moves so quickly, companies do disappear. They get bought, they go out of business.
That's exactly right.
New ones come up. So yeah, it is very interesting.
People, you know, as people are, you know, come the new sort of younger people kind of coming in, they may not know your brand, you know, so you're relying on a heritage or legacy of a certain group for the next lot coming along, if you're still not speaking to them or not making it relevant to them, then they won't know who you are. You know, so you always kind of need to be front of mind and present, you know, to stay relevant. You know, how you do it, of course, is a different matter depending on your brand, but yeah.
So I know that on a personal level, you're a very purpose-driven person, and a lot of your extracurricular activities in the industry are as important to you as your commercial activities. And you said that you have launched a new industry group called Join Our Table, which I think is a fantastic name. So what is it, and you know, what are the aims?
Yes, so launched it on the 1st of October. So
congratulations.
And thanks for supporting us as well. We deliberately launched it around Black History Month. Join Our Table is an initiative for there are eight Black women in the marketing, advertising, and media industry who are looking to spotlight Black women talent in our industry. And so it's about equity, yeah. It's about celebration. It's about spotlighting those, you know, who otherwise may be hidden. You know, we are in a media industry. You would expect that our numbers will be reflective of a more diverse, I guess, group of people. But sadly, we still languish at the bottom when it comes to Black women in particular. We may recruit, but we don't retain. And so what we want to do is address those who go, well, we don't know where they are. We don't know how to access them. So we are dialing that up by creating a hub, a space where those people are there to then shine a light so that supporters or people who want to access those talented women are there. So we're doing it for ourselves, but with that, you know, obviously with the support of allies. And Join Our Table is deliberately meant to have an inclusive, you know, message, you know, really, which is to draw people in. So, yeah, so we launched that on the 1st. And, yeah, it was born out of a few of us going to Cannes earlier on this year and looking around and going, yes, we're here, but we're not as visible as we'd like to be. So a meeting of minds, we came back and decided that we need to step up and use our space, the ones who are in the room or have managed to get around a table, to use our leverage and ensure that the ladder is down for others to get in and around the table and just sort of address the balancing, I suppose, and try and redress it. So that's Join Our Table. Yeah.
On a purely, you know, just anecdotal, my anecdotal experience of it is that, you know, we're often looking for Black speakers for events, and you want to have a representative speaker lineup. And I can 100% see the problem that you're talking about there. You know, in that there will be occasionally people who pop up, and then in a year or two, maybe they're gone. So there definitely does seem to be that retention problem. And I think to sort of dig into the reasons behind that, I think would be interesting, why we aren't sort of doing enough retaining.
Well, I mean, you know, you've got obviously the audience, you know, we've done some research. You don't need to look very far to sort of see the numbers, the percentages. And so, yeah, we are very low compared, you know, to other counterparts. We have had one or two people ask, well, why just Black women? And it's not we're not saying it's exclusive. It's not saying that there aren't other groups who aren't needing support. We're just doing this one for us because we represent what we're trying to elevate, you know, and we are welcoming those to support us in that space. So yeah, that's what it's here for. And we're trying to do it for us as opposed to sitting there waiting for it to be done for us. You know, we want to take the, you know, bull by the horns and kind of drive it and get people on to support it.
I think part of the function, it might, I'm not saying this as you know, I'm certainly not a DI expert, but I know, for example, I know somebody who started a company, and he was saying how hard it was for him to shift the culture in his company, just on gender. And he was saying, he said he started the company with a friend of his who was a male friend. They added a couple of people who were other friends of theirs in the industry. And all, he said, just from that point on, you know, from them being four men, it was like all of a sudden for any sort of new female members of staff, when they did sort of think, okay, oh good, you know, we need to, you know, have a more sort of balanced company culture. And it's something that this person genuinely, I know well and genuinely believes in, wanted for his company. But he just felt it was quite an intimidating environment for any, you know, if you hired one woman to come in, intimidating is probably the wrong word, but you know, you want to be entirely comfortable with it's just four guys. So they have this retention problem. And I think that's part of the challenge that seems to come around when people are, you know, even when they're being sincere and trying to address a problem or to rebalance things, if it's done in a kind of piecemeal way and the person is feeling a bit lonely within the organization and they're the only person like them, it's very challenging. It can be very challenging for people. I think until people have experienced it themselves, it's quite hard for people to
That's exactly right. And you think the thing is, you do see situations like that, like what you described, where people want to sort of give it a go, but then it may be that the culture doesn't sort of, well, it's not about sort of culture, although you do need to look at that sometimes, but it's that you haven't necessarily adjusted, you know, to the fact that you are going to be four or five men and one woman in the room. You know, you just carry on, and not necessarily sort of work, you know, and be collaborative in how you can adjust to ensure that that woman feels as included and comfortable, you know, as you. Yeah. And so having an open conversation about these things, I think, is so key, even though it might be uncomfortable. I think it's best to do it. Not putting all the burden then. So, for example, with this, you know, you might find situations where a black woman comes in onto, I don't know, a leadership team, and everybody else isn't that. And then the onus now is on that person to do everything around ethnicity and, you know, dealing with all the troubles and tribulations around that. And that's a massive burden to place on someone and triggering. Yeah. So it's just how you work sort of collaborative, and just be prepared to be uncomfortable. And that's okay. You know, but giving it a go is better than not. And recognizing the problem 100% needs to be done, as opposed to going, well, it's not a big deal. Because ultimately, it's not just about representation and the message you're sending outwards to those kind of coming up, or you as a brand telling, I don't know, consumers that you are, you know, doing these things from a moral perspective, or, you know, the right thing to do. It's actually beneficial to your brand, you know, financially. If you have a more diverse group of people in the room, you know, contributing to your output, say, you know, it's certainly going to be richer, and it informs your bottom line ultimately upwards. So whichever way you look at it, you know, there's a benefit to it, as opposed to a nice to have.
I certainly think with staff as well, I think nobody wants to work in a place where they feel like it's a monoculture where other people aren't welcome. I don't think there's, I think it's a struggle nowadays to find people who actually want that. So what sort of progress have we made in the industry since, you know, BLM? We had lots of, you know, public commitments and proclamations and I think, you know, my feeling at the time was people were being sincere in wanting to do it. You know, that, maybe there are exceptions out there, but I did feel there was a big cultural shift and a recognition that more needs to be done. But, you know, I'm just curious about the extent to which momentum has been maintained on these things, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, you know, from BLM, I think it's all been snowballing, hasn't it, really? Everything's it hasn't stopped. You obviously have a pandemic that was around the time when May, you know, sort of happened, and then you've then got the costs of living crisis. You've got the war. I mean, it's all going on. It's just never ending. So there's a lot sort of happening. But I would say yes, there was an awakening, you know, to those who otherwise haven't. Just seemed to be living under a rock or didn't think it was relevant to them. And yes, there was an intention that was that then sort of presented itself when people realized that something needed to be done. And I think that even reflected in the recruitment side of things, you know, where there was more of a push to recruit a more diverse group of people, particularly people of colour and you know, sort of black and brown people in the mix, and then women and so on. But what I feel has happened, not all the time, is there has been a lot of focus on the recruitment and maybe not as much on the retention. So people have come in to the industry, things haven't quite shifted in the sense of ensuring that they feel included or that they belong, or some things are not necessarily overly addressed, unconscious bias, microaggressions, all those things, the culture potentially, and then they leave. So we still have this issue of not retaining said people that we know we need to bring in, you know, to the industry still. And then of course, if you then look at, you know, women or black women, we're literally right at the bottom. So yeah, I think, and then you then got companies that are caught up with everything else that's going on that I listed earlier. So it's still an ongoing challenge. The good thing is we are talking about it. It wasn't something that was talked about before. We're in Black History Month. You know, people, although Black History is obviously every year. In fact, we call it Black History. It's history. So we talk about it, and it's, you know, more people have more companies have embraced it and celebrated. So there's a move, a shift, definitely. It's just, you know, it's taken far longer than we would have liked. And if you look at things a bit more broadly now, with all the other sort of more nationalist type of way of thinking, or all the other pressures that's, you know, sort of pushing the rise of, I guess, those who lean far more to the right, it makes it that much harder.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of the far right and particularly, you know, white nationalism. I mean, to what extent do you think that is a reaction? You know, do you feel like there's you know, it concerns me sometimes that maybe by emphasizing our differences that it's a very difficult one. Let me start with Northern Ireland, where Northern Ireland went from, you know, people with deeply entrenched identities that were reinforced daily with, you know, various cultural rituals. You know, the differences were rammed down people's throats. There was massive inequities between one group and the other one. And somehow we've managed to come out another side where Northern Ireland's far from perfect, but there's definitely been a massively progressive shift in the, you know, in Northern Ireland. And I feel like the relinquishing of identities, and certainly not by everyone, and not, but the fact that there's less emphasis on nationalism, particularly as each generation passes, you know, people are sort of seeing their commonality. And I feel like that's something that's, you know, helped us sort of progress and move forward. The flip side of that, I think, is in order to get there, you had to identify within your group. So, for example, Catholics in Northern Ireland, or, you know, Irish nationalists had to organize in order, you know, and emphasize their identity in order to express what was going wrong. We've come out the other side. Now the identity thing is calming down. And I suppose what I'm trying to get at is I'm worried that, you know, by emphasizing our differences, how do we get to that post peace process stage, I suppose, where we maybe come out and have a slightly more unified society?
Yeah, I mean, it's a debate in itself. We need another podcast for this, yeah. Vincent. I know what you're saying, and I think about this question. I think, gosh, are we? Is it utopia? Are we looking for a perfect thing that actually doesn't need to be what is actually perfect? You know, and that's the thing. But I think, yes, you're right. Some could argue that by focusing on the, you know, specific sort of identity specific groups, right, that you're perpetuating that inequity, and you know you're continuing to perpetuate it, right, as opposed to just, you know, fully embracing it so that doesn't exist and we're all one, right?
Yeah.
You then got the other side, which is, you know, celebrating those, the diversity, right, the benefits and the identities, and yeah, you know, so instead of saying to me, I don't see color, I want you to see me, you know, yes, I'm not, you know, I look like this versus you that looks different, and that's okay. So I think I may have mentioned this to you before, but I look at it as a bit of a kaleidoscope where you've got all the wonderful different colors in the mix, yeah. And those are unique in themselves, I ask. But they create this whole picture, which is a whole. And that is a picture, you know, with little or big, you know, colors in the mix. And a kaleidoscope is a beautiful thing to look at, but it's got individual, unique sort of shapes, pictures within it. And that's how I look at it. I don't think it's an either or. I think it's more about, at the end of the day, do you feel like you are, you know, seen? Do you feel that you are respected? Are you treated fairly? Are you valued? You know, are you able to reach your full potential regardless of your identity? I think those ultimately is where we want to get to. Whether or not you look the way you look, or you know, whether or not you are celebrating that you are from this place or that place, or that you have all these other sort of things that would put you in a marginalized group, right? I think it's more about ultimately how you are treated as an individual that matters.
I love the kaleidoscope analogy. It was like, oh, it's what I think of. When I think of London, you know, that matches very well where, yeah, you know, I think most people who live in London, you're kind of here because you want that difference, you know, you're excited by it. It's, you know, it's what makes it such an interesting and fun place to live.
Exactly. You're walking down the street and you will see graffiti and, you know, some other sorts of things. But, you know, you go around the corner and then you just see a mixture of all sorts going on, and it's okay, you know. So, yeah, you embrace it all.
So you're also part of the leadership team at Bloom. Now, I don't know if UK, I think most people in the UK industry will have seen Bloom at some point on LinkedIn feed. I certainly know people, and I've seen this said on an all-male WhatsApp group, where people were just saying the work that they do is absolutely incredible, and that colleagues who've been through the Bloom mentoring process, they said it was like night and day in terms of the impact of having those people, like really incredibly impactful. So for those who don't know what Bloom is, could you maybe explain a bit of an overview of what it is and what your work is there?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I'm president of Bloom this year. I've been in Bloom for 3 years now. So my last couple of years, I was in the leadership team as head of allyship, and also actually co-founded Bloom in Colour, because I recognised Bloom, and one, it was a wonderful network, but again, we weren't maybe as representative as we could be when it came to ethnicity. So Bloom in Colour was born as one of the inclusion groups within Bloom. And so, yeah, it's president this year, which is amazing. And yeah, Bloom is a network of shy of 500 women in our industry. We've been going for about 13 years now. And it's all about, I guess, ultimately pushing that message about gender equality, about challenging the industry to do better, you know, when it comes to not just us as women and the representation and be treated equally and all of that, but also the recognition that we are women, but within that, there is an intersectional lens that needs to be applied, which is my big thing for this year. So yes, we're all women, but you know, you do have those who are neurodiverse, say, or you know, there's a whole conversation around menopause and ageism, and that needing not to be taboo subjects because it's just, you know, it is certainly menopause is natural, or women's health, where you know you get those who suffer in silence because they don't feel that they can talk about certain areas, you know, or disability, visible and invisible. So we cover all that within Blue, and we have inclusion groups that reflect all of those. And we use the insight to then inform what we do, which we then pull together to then challenge the industry to sit up and you know, ultimately affect some policies where we can. So we've come out with some working documents, say, for example. So we did something around parenting. We called it a Great Return. And you can find all this. It's all open source on Bloom. Bloom's website, Bloom UK's website, where, you know, it's just sort of guidance around, you know, parents who are kind of coming back to work, women, that is. We pulled together an allyship code, which is really for leaders who just want like a checklist, you know, on how to go about being an active, good ally. And then we have something called the manifesto, which is all about menopause and using that to inform policy within companies. So we don't just sit around the table and have a cup of tea or coffee or maybe something more stronger. We actually are a group of women or volunteers who pull together to help have a collective voice for women when it comes into an industry. And one bit I want to mention as well, which is, I think we talked about before you referenced it, is we also have a program called The Exchange, which is actually a reverse mentoring program where it's men in our industry with women in Bloom, because we do think it's very important to have, obviously, our men allies with us on this journey, you know, because we can't, otherwise we'll just be in a chamber echoing. Yeah, so, yeah, the exchange program is amazing. We've had, you know, senior men in the industry who have joined and absolutely loved it. And the whole point of it is to then go back into the industry and use their insight, because it's obviously a value exchange, and take that back into the industry and actually use that to hopefully give insights, inform change policy and so on. So, yeah, so we do a lot, you know, at Bloom, but hopefully that gives you a flavour.
Yeah, I remember somebody explained to me everything that Bloom does, and it sort of sounds like you've got the infrastructure of a small state, basically. It's incredible.
I know the people are. Do you know what? The goodwill is incredible. I mean, I should say this one up here. We it's non-profits. We put all the money, anything that we make. We support Women's Aid. That's our charity that we support, as well as Believe, which is an amazing charity that support young women, you know, coming up in the industry and support them in making the right sort of life choices for their careers and so on. So that's our give back, right? But you're right. It's when I sit back, I I'm humbled. And what is beautiful, because sometimes it can be. I mean, this is not my day job. I'm doing this on top of my day job and other networks that I'm part of as well. But when you then meet people who go, this has changed my life. I've, you know, become more confident in this space. I've, you know, developed in my career. I've taken on this challenge because of the advice. It's a sisterhood. It's a network of support. You know, people are, like I said, those inclusion groups really are valuable for members because you don't feel like you're alone. And when you are a collective voice, people do listen, you know, because when we come together, Bloom's respected. It's just, it's humbling. It makes you feel, that's what it's all about.
So final question. We offer £10 million of imaginary money. Hopefully one day we'll be able to give this away to contributors. £10 million to invest. And, you know, yeah, where would you invest that money? And, yeah, what would be your motivation for your investment?
Right. I've given this thought a lot of times. I think we all do. So I would say I would look at investing in fit-for-purpose care homes. Or this is my vision, right? So you've got this, I don't know, not commune, but certainly area of all like self-contained flats. And you've got a doctor on hand and all these other bits to support you as you move away from, well, you move into becoming older where you need that. And you look out for each other, you know, so in a care home-esque type manner, or residential homes sort of manner, but that's fit for purpose, you know, that ensures that you've got your independence still, you have friends or people, a community around you, and there's dignity and so on. So I would say certainly a care home stroke residential type outfit. And then the other thing would be youth centres. I think it's terrible that we shut down or don't have youth centres, and I would invest in bringing them back so that kids have something to do when they are out of school.
I was working on a youth music project in Camden, and they had big cutbacks. It was sort of after the financial crash. And the role, like, you know, I think some people don't fully appreciate just how important they are and the role that they play.
100%.
Particularly for kids where maybe there was a difficult situation at home, or, you know, maybe there was nobody at home, you know, that maybe it was a single mom who had to work late, and
100%.
That wasn't the picture. And it would literally, I mean, it was like a family atmosphere, and you realize that it's way more than, okay, you're not robbing shops because you're playing table tennis or recording a song. It was far deeper than that. You know, it wasn't just about occupying people. It was playing an additional function. So I completely, wholeheartedly agree with you on the youth side of things. The old folks home thing as well, with an aging population and concerns around how everyone's going to be looked after, that seems like a very worthwhile investment. And if you start that, count me in, because
I think do it earlier. Don't wait till you reach the age where you can't do anything about it. Pull it together, define it. That is 100%. Those two things is what I would do. I'll just set it up where it's all there for you, and it changed the model, you know, from what currently is there. Because you're right, aging population, I don't know where we're going.
It sounds a little bit like that, you know, that there's a care, sort of an open air care home for people with Alzheimer's in the Netherlands, and, you know, you can wander out of your flat, go into the shops, forget, you know, and everyone around you, that they think that they're, you know, waiting at the bus stop, or, you know, and living a sort of dignified, normal life.
Yes.
But in fact, everyone around the place is some form of carer who's trained to look after them and guide them along. But it's a lovely idea. It's probably expensive. I think the expense is often the
oh, yes, I know it will be. Yeah, but 10 million, I think that will certainly go towards getting it going.
Fantastic. Well, Elizabeth, that was an absolutely wonderful conversation, and thanks so much for coming on.
I have had a wonderful time too. Thanks so much for having me.